Chapter 3. Having managed to endure the relentless teasing of my horrid first day at St. Peter's Preparatory School, I lay quietly in my bedroom that night like a new arrival at Colditz, planning how I was going to survive. There was just one shaft of hope, my shadow. I was already very attached to my shadow. He was an older boy named John Reed, and under the St. Peter's system, he had been assigned to me, accompanying me wherever I went, guiding, explaining, warning, encouraging, and making sure that wherever I was, I knew what I was supposed to be doing. He was very kind and supportive, and all these years later, I still feel grateful to him, even though he left St. Peter's shortly afterwards, never to be seen again. By me, that is. I don't mean he was suddenly rendered invisible or even transparent. Without Reed's kindness, I would have slunk off and hidden in a dustbin, also never to be seen again, since all the other boys seemed to detest me. Certainly my social skills were poor. For example, I still had the idea that kicking other boys' bottoms would eventually make me more popular. And I was irritatingly tall and pathetic and wet, but Reed got me through the first 2 weeks. After that, I had a chance. I had one other survival technique. I sometimes said things that made the other boys laugh. Now, when this happened, I immediately experienced a moment of warmth, of acceptance, of feeling maybe I am all right after all. Peter Cook always said that he quite deliberately staved off bullying by being funny. I think in my case it was less a conscious activity, more, oh, that felt nice. And as I relaxed, I became funnier, of course, because the spark was always there. So the bullying faded away, and I started, for the first time, to make friends. So far as schoolwork was concerned, I was quite unexceptional. After a couple of terms of very gentle stuff, dictation and making papier-mâché puppets and telling stamens from pistols, I moved up to Form 2, where all the teachers were men, except for the headmaster's wife, who was more than a match for any male at St. Peter's, including the headmaster. Now I began Latin, which was taught by Captain Lancaster, a fine military-looking man with an impeccable mane of white hair, a bushy but clipped white moustache, a very red, smooth face, and a fearsome temper, according to tradition. Learning became a serious business because we were terrified of his getting into a bait. A lot of our work with him involved rote learning, which I quite enjoyed, declining nouns and adjectives and conjugating verbs, and my God, did he drum it into us, because even today I can still remember it all without even pausing to think. Funnily enough, I never actually saw him lose his fearsome temper, but that was only because we made sure that he didn't. Later, I discovered that despite his military bearing and title and his reputation for fierceness, his tendency sometimes to seem a bit gruff was entirely due to his shyness. Underneath it all, he was an extraordinarily gentle and sweet-natured man. He would tell us how to recognize bird songs, and he would read to us from Three Men in a Boat, provided we'd done the work. Somehow his terrifying reputation had obscured his essential kindness, and the fact that he taught P.E. and boxing and shooting and held the military title of captain all helped the deception. I was always quite good at Latin and at maths. I'm not sure why. Maybe it was because both had a certain simple logic to them that my mind could cope with. You learn rules and then you applied them. When it came to English, I was only okay, and I was rather bad at everything else, especially French, which left me bewildered. You had to make strange noises that I had never heard before, which bore no relation whatsoever to the words on the page. Why didn't they? Well, what's the point? And then history. Why was I being told that King Alfred burned the cakes? If it was just that they didn't want me to burn cakes, why didn't they just say so? What had King Alfred got to do with it? And anyway, if he was king, what on earth was he doing the cooking? And what was King Canute up to, chatting away to the sea? Why did they make him king if he was barking mad, surely the courtiers on the beach would have hushed it all up. None of it made any sense at all, and that rattled me, as I was still at an age when I thought things were meant to make sense, and I got quite anxious when they didn't. Worst of all was Scripture. Scripture actually frightened me. To start with, it had all the random pointlessness of history. Okay, there was a man called Ahab, who, the Bible says, walked delicately. And somebody called Jehu, who rode furiously, and probably somebody called Ezekiel, who drew badly. But this was thousands of years ago. Why was I expected to memorize this stuff? True, there was a vague assumption that doing so would bring me closer to God, but then who was God when he was at home? And why did he keep losing it with his chosen people when he could easily have changed his mind and picked a more cooperative bunch? Nothing was ever explained. Just as it was always taken for granted that you knew why it was important to study Latin, or to churn out papier-mâché puppets, or to know where flax was grown, so my teachers also unanimously assumed that I knew how Catholics differed from Protestants, or that I understood what eternal life was, as though I'd seen it on a shelf in the grocery shop. But the reason that Scripture alarmed me the most was that it was clearly supposed to be important, because it was read out by the headmaster at prayers every single morning, yet I could not grasp what any of it was about, despite the fact that it appeared to be in English. If he'd read it out in Flemish, I could have relaxed, knowing that it was not supposed to be comprehensible to me, but obviously I was expected to take it in. Let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth. Come again? Blessed are the meek. Oh, yeah? Well, it doesn't seem to be getting me anywhere. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's ox. Are you joking? Any of this could have been interesting if the teacher had chatted about it with us and in terms of our own experiences. So why didn't they? The neurologist and psychiatrist Maurice Nicol told how he had once asked his headmaster about a passage in the Bible, and after he'd listened to the answer for some time, he realized that the man had no idea what he was talking about. What I admire about Nicol is that he made this discovery when he was only 10. It took me another 45 years before the penny dropped. Very, very few people have any idea what they are talking about. Imagine if just one of St. Peter's schoolmasters had told me in 1949, you must always remember that 90% of what you're told is purest bullshit. Imagine what an intellectual kickstart that would have been. When I went for my regular Sunday evening walk with Dad, during which I would carefully discuss all my worries about the approaching week, and he would reassure me and give me the courage to go over the top on Monday morning, a lot of my anxiety was about trying to understand just what the hell was going on and what it all meant. However, the single most surprising and indeed disorienting event in my early St. Peter's life took place one afternoon during rest, when we all sat at our desk reading Biggles and Billy Bunter and digesting lunch. I glanced up from my book, and there, about 15 feet to my right, was one of my classmates. He had stopped reading and was carefully stroking something in his lap. I was curious. What was it that he had there that he was caressing with such loving kindness? You, gentle listener, will be some way ahead of the 9-year-old Cleese, who was tossing out hypothesis after hypothesis in his search for understanding. Finally, it was granted. Rather like those early Pacific Islanders who were unable to see a big boat that had arrived on their shores because it was entirely beyond their experience that such a large boat could exist, I took a very long time to drink in the reality of what I was definitely observing. But then the scales fell from my eyes, and I consciously acknowledged that this classmate of mine was attending to his penis. In my own defense, I have to say, with the benefit of hindsight, that the calm, unruffled ease with which he did so, rather as though he was unhurriedly sharpening a favourite pencil, put me off the scent. It was not possible that a private part could be publicised in this matter-of-fact quotidian manner. There must be some other explanation, and as I sat there frantically grasping for an alternative interpretation, a boy from my left, keeping low as he ran, so as not to be spotted by the master on duty, himself reading at the far end of the room, passed in front of me over to the penis boy and crouched down beside him to obtain a ringside view of the proceedings. I could not have been more astonished at what I was spectating if the two of them had quietly levitated, morphed into pterodactyls, and flown out of the window. From this moment, my mind remains a blank. My next memory is sitting at home, telling all to Dad. Next day, he had a chat with the headmaster, Mr. Tolson. The following day, I was allowed to stay home while the headmaster addressed the entire school on the subject of private parts. It was typically decent of Mr. Tolson to see that, had I been there to hear his address, my facial colour would have identified the fifth columnist in the school's midst. And I should explain that what I had beheld was not for me what adults would think of sexual. It was simply that my understanding was that a penis was intended to be kept private. But in other areas I was becoming less diffident, or in St. Peter's parlance, less wet. Indeed, on one occasion I actually got into a fight with a boy who was teasing me. There I was, lying on the floor, grappling with him like a proper schoolboy. I even banged his head on the floor, at which point I thought, oh my God, if I start losing, he'll do this to me. And then, of course, I started losing. Fortunately, my form master, Mr. Howdle, arrived and broke the fight up, and funnily enough, it was about then that the bullying stopped. This first fight also proved to be my last. I thought so, anyway, until I read in the Sunday Times recently that I had a fight with Terry Gilliam in the 80s. I think this unlikely, owing to the relatively rare occurrence of fisticuffs in the Cleese life. It must be statistically probable that I would remember such an uncommon event. It would tend to stand out sharply from the rather less pugilistic tone of the rest of my life. And I definitely don't recall having a fight with Terry Gilliam. May I also point out that if I had, I would almost certainly have killed him. I think the only possible explanation for the Sunday Times article, if it is true, was that Terry attacked me, but that I failed to notice he was doing so. Terry is very short due to his bandy little legs, so when he scuttles around, he stays so close to the floor that it can be difficult to see what he's up to down there. But I digress. Another reason for my decline in diffidence was that I was playing a lot of games with other boys, which served to loosen me up a bit. Not just those activities which required neither courage nor strength, like table tennis or chess or snooker, but also, because my hand-eye coordination was good, a few team games, except, obviously, for rugby, which was invented for nasty, rough boys. I never actually understood many of the rules of the games I was playing, but then that didn't seem to matter much to small boys. I once watched two boys playing a chess match, and noticing that one of the kings had actually been taken, I pointed this fact out to them, only to be informed, "We know." Anyway, what happened is, every now and again, you learn another rule until eventually you know enough to play properly, except for rugby, where even at international level, only the referee understands all the rules and has to explain them to the players, especially the very large ones, every time he makes a decision. It was about now that I encountered the teacher who made the greatest impression on me, Mr. Bartlett. He became my math master, and during the first term that he taught me, I have to confess I understood nothing. But when he taught me the same things the following term, I grasped them instantly. They had all become self-evident. So I moved up a form where Mr. Bartlett introduced me to new mathematical ideas, all of them incomprehensible, until the following term when they became blindingly obvious, and I assimilated them effortlessly. Promotion, in other words, was followed by bewilderment and, in the next term, by full comprehension. Mr. Bartlett was a very good teacher. But Mr. Bartlett's ultimate significance to every single one of us lay in the psychological spell that he cast over us. It became astonishingly important to please him, not just individually, but as a form, too. So we attended to his every word, and when we had prep to do for him in the evening, we tried desperately hard to do good work. I can recall one evening when we were all sitting in the big room solving some geometry problems that Mr. Bartlett had set us, that a boy called David Rogers was experiencing technical problems with his pair of compasses, that gadget with a sharp metal point which you stick in a sheet of paper when you revolve the rest of the apparatus around it to produce a perfectly drawn circle. I slowly became aware of Rogers' growing distress at the next desk. It seemed that every time he was on the verge of completing a nice, neat circle, the point of his compass slipped, and the pencil slid with it, producing a nasty blur on the page and ruining his almost completed circle. At which moment, Rogers would emit a tiny, half-strangled cry of rage, seize his India rubber, and savagely rub out his oh-so-near circle, then grab the compass, stab its point into the page, which, after the first four or five attempts, was beginning to resemble a lightly ploughed field, and start rotating the compass incredibly painstakingly until the pencil had described an arc of 355 degrees, at which moment the compass point would skid again, spoiling all his fine work up to that instant, forcing from Rogers another muffled howl of despair and sending him into a renewed frenzy of rubbing out that began to resemble an act of pure revenge. But revenge on what? On life itself, it seemed. What was so funny, I decided later, was not the anger itself, but the fear that underlay it, the sheer terror of losing Bartlett's favour, of being cast into the outer darkness for the rest of the term. That was the extraordinary power of the force with which he controlled us. It was not fear of his rage, it was fear of the withdrawal of his approval. Years later, I realized it was just like a lover's sulk, and we all know the strangely powerful effect of that. Now, Rogers did something that was, up to that point in my life, the funniest thing I had ever seen. He went and borrowed a penknife, walked determinedly over to a waste paper basket, and in a rigidly controlled but slightly quivering mother of all cold furies, began savagely sharpening the point of his compass with the penknife. The idea that the metal compass could be made pointier by whetting it with an ordinary penknife, compounded by the icy, maniacally restrained way in which he was attempting it, while all the time just stifling the seething, roiling bloodlust motivating him. All of this, masking the sickening dread of Bartlett's impending withdrawal of affection. Such a perfect comic storm utterly wrecked me. The more I cried with laughter, though, the steelier became Roger's determination to make the compass point more efficient. Roger's emotional state was, in fact, almost identical to the one Connie Booth and I tried to create for Basil in each episode of Fawlty Towers. And since so much has been written about Basil's anger, and so much of it's simplistic or just plain wrong, it's perhaps worth trying to set the record right, although I suspect such an attempt is doomed to failure. Basil's anger is almost always underpinned by fear. Fear of a hotel inspector's bad report, fear of having poisoned a guest, fear of a health inspector seeing a rat, fear of upsetting important guests like visiting psychiatrists or a lord, fear of offending German guests, fear of revealing that the chef is unfit to cook on gourmet night, fear of making a fool of himself in front of his friends invited to his wedding anniversary, fear of American guests discovering that the chef is not actually in the kitchen, fear of his wife catching him in compromising situations with an Australian blonde or an attractive French woman, fear of his wife discovering he's been betting on horses and trying to save money by employing incompetent builders. Need I go on? Then, because of the stress caused by his fear, he starts at the beginning of each episode by making small mistakes. As his efforts to correct the fearful situation misfire, he becomes increasingly panicky and desperate, and consequently, his decision-making becomes worse and worse until he's dug a hole, or several holes, for himself, from which there is no real escape. It's just good old-fashioned farce. One, the protagonist has done something he has to cover up. Two, he makes increasingly poor choices due to his building panic. Three, he finishes up in ridiculous situations. Four, his sins are finally revealed. Or he just escapes detection, and all's well that ends well. Incidentally, please forgive the he in the paragraph above, but I do not know of a classic farce where the protagonist is female. I should point out one other parallel between Basil Fawlty and David Rogers. It is suppressed anger that is funny. If Basil ever fully lost his temper and started screaming at people, the audience wouldn't laugh. It's when he tries to control it, but shows telltale signs that he's failing. Profitless sarcasm, smacking his own bottom, flogging a car, speaking in an exaggeratedly deliberate way, suddenly slamming down a phone, that he's funny, in the same way that David Rogers was when his measured compass sharpening betrayed the dreadful fury underlying it. Another way of looking at this, real anger can work in real life, it won't work as comedy. Funny anger is ineffectual anger. So, anyway, Mr. Bartlett was impressive not just because of his teaching skills and the control that he exercised over us. He was also the first example I'd ever seen of a really impressive human being. This manifested itself in two ways. First, he seemed to know everything about everything. The slow realization of this, along with my growing sense of awe, suggested to me that if only I could acquire enough information about all aspects of the world, I too could be in total control of my life and invulnerable to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, specifically put-downs and sarcasm and teasing. So I began to be obsessed with the feeling that I ought to know everything about everything. I may have lacked the brain and willpower to move this project forward, but that never shook my conviction that omniscience would solve all possible problems. The second aspect of Mr. Bartlett's character that influenced me and several generations of St. Peter's boys was his fastidious demeanour. His life appeared to be a continuous one-gentleman crusade against all things vulgar. I'm not referring to what in Britain in 2016 would be called vulgar, crude talk about bottoms and breasts and side breasts and underboobs and genitalia, cursing, aggressive and insulting behaviour, body piercing, tacky clothing, drunkenness, bling, shaven heads, tattoos, reality television, marketing, and all the other vibrant forms of conduct that make our great country what it is today. No, Mr. Bartlett was appalled, his favourite word, by much subtler stuff. For example, by the slightest hint of showing off or drawing attention to oneself, what he called self-advertisement. What would he have made of our celebrity culture? This was the Edwardian gentleman's approach to life. Courtesy, grace, restraint, the careful avoidance of embarrassing others, non-intrusiveness, considerateness, kindness, modesty, nay, more than modesty, self-effacement, the very things that would disqualify one forever from employment by the Daily Mail. But the charm of it all was that there was humour, and indeed a hint of playfulness about his constant state of being appalled. And he was not often deeply appalled. Sometimes he was only slightly appalled, for example, at our stupidity, of which there was a lot about. There was a wonderful deadpan look of bemused astonishment in the way in which he greeted our latest imbecility, and, if we pleased him, an almost coy twinkle. We craved that in some boys, his favourites, received it now and again. He was our tall, long-faced, high-brow god, and we loved and feared him. If we'd handed in bad work, he would walk into the classroom looking as though his mother had just been fed into a mincer, and announce, "So, it's war." And then he would stalk slowly over to the window and stare vacantly out of it, and we would all want to kill ourselves, and would pray for the moment when he would smile at one of us again. He didn't care for me at all, but I could always hope. Meanwhile, I loved him for his jokes. When he called one boy a waste of space, I thought it was the most brilliantly witty line that had ever been said since the world began. I still believe this, even though I know it wasn't original. There was one master who quite liked me, no doubt in part because I quite liked him. Nobody else liked him, though, perhaps because he was physically unattractive. Actually, that's not true. I was being polite. He was ugly. God, he was ugly. He could have won competitions without taking his teeth out. Rather surprisingly and endearingly, he was also a bit vain, always fussing about his hair and glancing in the mirror. It was strangely touching to see him battle on in this way against insuperable odds, rather like Quasimodo using eyeliner, or the Elephant Man wearing a toupee. His name was the Reverend A. H. Dolman, and he was German. That's all we knew, although we had a pretty good idea of what the A stood for. He was equally repellent in a variety of other ways, too. He was very fat, sorry, obese, and he waddled around bumping people and blocking doorways, and his breath was not good. So we tried not to stand too close, and he told laboured, pointless jokes, which he then explained, and he had a rather guttural, surprise, accent, and spoke an unfamiliar dialect of English, peppered with certain pet phrases like actually speaking, and really speaking, and generally speaking, and normally speaking, and especially in actual fact, which popped up every 20 seconds or so. So, naturally speaking, we started counting the number of times he said them all. He took over responsibility for teaching us Latin from Captain Lancaster. Quite how I managed to learn from him is a mystery, but I did because I like Latin, and that's the main reason, I think, why we finished up almost liking each other. Which was just as well, because when Mr. Tolson asked Mr. Bartlett if I should compete for a maths scholarship to Clifton College in 1953, and Bartlett killed the idea, dear Reverend Dolman insisted that I should be put up for a Latin scholarship. I failed to get that, but for some reason the enterprise yielded me the maths one, worth £35 a year. So put that in your pipe and smoke it, God. As far as I can remember, I liked all the other teachers, Mr. Gilbert, Mr. Howdle, Mr. Sanger Davies, called Sanger Wagtail after the way he walked, Mr. Tom, who wore suede shoes with crepe soles and seemed a bit racy compared with the others, and nice Mr. Hickley, the music teacher, who eventually expelled me from singing classes because I was both tragically ungifted and also a bit subversive. I had my revenge on him when, 15 years later, I became the only one of his pupils ever to appear in a Broadway musical. In fact, it was quite odd how fond I was of them all. When the boys played the staff in the annual cricket match, the latter using very narrow shaved bats, I always wanted the masters to win, even when I was playing. I think because I trusted Dad so much and always believed that he was acting in my best interest, I somehow transferred my faith in him onto the masters, who were a uniformly decent, kind crowd anyway. Whatever I felt about them, though, the only ones I suspect to have had a soft spot for me were the Reverend Dolman and the headmaster. The first impression Mr. Tolson made was that he was big. Actually, he wasn't that big, but he seemed so to us. He was 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders and a barrel chest and a large round face and a welcoming smile and slightly unfocused eyes behind wide rimless glasses. and on top of everything, a fine, expansive, completely bald, surprisingly pink dome. The second impression he made was that he was sort of important. You felt that he definitely owned the school and that what he said went. More than that, the tone of the school was an extension of himself. And thirdly, and most unusually, I was to learn, he was quite an emotionally open man, quite unlike the exquisitely refined Mr. Bartlett, or the fearsomely gruff and shy Captain Lancaster, or the rebarbative Reverend Dolman. He was basically optimistic, warm, encouraging, and utterly decent. But he was quite easily upset, especially if boys were wet or disorder threatened, or if our great rivals, St. Dunstan's or Bernamont-sea, beat us at football. And he reserved his most ruffled and pink look for occasions when he had tangled with the beautiful, elegant, and almost imperious Jean Tolson, a dark, Latinate thoroughbred who could strike a man dead at 30 paces with one blow of her tongue. But when I said that what Geoffrey Tolson said went, this was not true if he said it to Mrs. Tolson, because then it would not go at all. In fact, it would probably back up a few paces and stay very still indeed. Most of the time, though, he was cheerful, and he often had a humorous glint in his eye and made well-intentioned jokes. I was hugely fond of and trusting of him. Oddly enough, the memory of him that stays with me the clearest was the occasion when he rebuked me for being cocky. He took me aside and explained that he'd heard the previous day my behaviour on the cricket field had been unseemly. Not that I'd said anything wrong, but that my body language had contained a hint of swagger, of conceit, of what the Aussies used to call putting on dog. And he was right. Recently I'd got the idea that I was rather good at cricket, and yes, I had been sort of showing off and being a bit pleased with myself and getting too big for my britches. And Tolson explained very gently that this kind of thing was not good form and should not be repeated. And I knew he was right, and I was rather ashamed, and I made sure it did not happen again. What interests me about this incident was that this relatively small amount of egotism or self-advertisement had clearly been reported to the highest authority straight away, and that within hours the threat of such unmanly Mediterranean conduct spreading to other boys had been efficiently snuffed out. Here, Tolson, Bartlett, Captain Lancaster, and the others were as one. No swank, no flamboyance, no putting on airs, no bad manners, no ungentlemanly behaviour. Contrast this with my experience during a couples therapy session a few years ago in California, where I explained to the very famous therapist that blowing one's own trumpet was regarded in England as a bit unsophisticated, if not slightly common, only to be told that tooting one's own horn was perfectly mature conduct and entirely socially acceptable. In an act that moulded my entire worldview, Mr. Tolson once took the whole school to see Scott at the Antarctic. We were all deeply impressed by Scott's uncomplaining acceptance of suffering. But you couldn't help feeling that the message of the film was not just that the highest form of English heroism is stoicism in the face of failure, but that in Scott's case, a whiff of success might have tarnished the gallantry of his silent endurance of misery. After all, he and his men all froze to death while losing the gold medal to the Norwegians in the same way that the magnificence of the Charge of the Light Brigade was enhanced by its utter futility, and General Gordon's being calmly hacked to death was all the more impressive because it occurred during the course of the complete annihilation of his forces at Khartoum. On the other hand, Lord Nelson's and General Wolfe's heroism may have lost a little of its sparkle by the close association with two all-important victories, even if they did get extra marks for being killed at the moment of their triumph. I think Americans must suspect that General Custer may have been of English descent. In fact, looking at the figures regarded as our national role models, it's hard to discern much joy or fun or optimism about any of them. There's almost a hint of depression around. It's interesting that the phrase joie de vivre is probably foreign. Nevertheless, even while we were being shown edifying lessons about the value of failure, and Mr. Tolson was reminding me of the need to harness my ego, my confidence continued to grow, if not my self-esteem. I have to thank my friends for that. A few years ago, an American psychologist, Judith Harris, scandalized the therapeutic establishment by suggesting that the influence of parents on a child's development had been overemphasized, while the impact of the peer group had been undervalued. Whatever the academic rights and wrongs of this viewpoint, there is no doubt that my wuss rating was dropping and that my wetness was perceptibly evaporating, and that this was the result of playing with my pals. It was definitely not to do with my achievements. They remained utterly mediocre, apart from maths and Latin, and I gave no sign of creative ability. When the Reverend Dolman cast me as Malvolio in Twelfth Night, I had absolutely no idea what I was supposed to be doing. Or saying, for that matter. I can still remember declaiming, M-O-A-I, this simulation is not as the former, and yet, to crush this a little, it would bow to me, for every one of these letters are in my name, without having a clue what it meant. Nobody explained anything, not even the significance of Malvolio appearing cross-gartered. But at least I went out there and said the lines in the right order, even if I don't remember getting a single laugh, and I didn't faint, and everyone seemed satisfied. In my last year at St. Peter's, however, I really did seem to take a big leap forward. I once read a book entitled Mastery by a deeply impressive man called George Leonard, who helped Michael Murphy run the Esalen Institute at Big Sur, where some of the brightest people in America, quote, went to talk about what was really on their minds, unquote. In it, he pointed out that when we work at acquiring some skill, we do not improve gradually, like some ascending straight line on a graph. The improvements take place suddenly, after a period of not appearing to get better at all. If we just keep patiently practicing, there will be an unexpected jump up to the next level. Plateau, jump, plateau, jump, plateau, jump. It's a bit like saltation in evolutionary theory. That had been my experience of learning maths with Mr. Bartlett, and now I suddenly seem to be good at a lot of things, and not just because I was now taller than any of the masters, including Mr. Tolson himself, although it did help in things like the high jump and boxing and hurdling and bowling and making me feel a bit more important than I'd ever seen before. I was now in a class of just 6 13-year-olds. It didn't feel like school. It was more like an exclusive learning club. We were being individually taught, and I loved it. Every subject became exciting and fun as never before, and, little did I know, as seldom again. I can remember thinking that in this atmosphere I seemed to be getting cleverer, and I was even improving in areas of life that had previously been a closed book to me, notably rugby. I was still too cowardly to be allowed in the first team, but as I was now about a yard taller than anyone else, when placed in the second team, I proved unstoppable. In our first match against King's School Taunton, I was past the ball. I saw the massed ranks of the King's second 15 just melt away in front of me, ran through them and scored. There was another kickoff. St. Peter's got the ball. It was passed to me and I scored again. Soon it became almost monotonous. In the old days, when I'd got the ball, I would pass it quickly before I got hurt. But now I cantered gently forward like a giraffe amongst pygmies, who each time fled before me like the Red Sea parting from Moses, allowing me to touch the ball down between the posts entirely unmolested. I estimate we won by about 430-0. The return match was more interesting. King's School kicked off, St. Peter's got the ball, gave it to me, and I set off. But suddenly I saw a small King's jersey running towards me instead of away. Now, naturally, this attracted my attention, It was clear that there was a tiny creature inside the jersey, and as I slowed to get a better view, it suddenly lowered its head, accelerated right at me, and butted me in the solar plexus. This produced a spectacular effect akin to a slow-motion demolition of the Eiffel Tower. I was carried off and had to lie at the edge of the pitch, unable to breathe, for half an hour while Kings built up a hefty half-time lead. However, by the start of the second half, I was back on the pitch, and the moment I got the ball, I looked for the assassin, and there he was, approaching at a good speed, too. So, timing my move carefully, I waited until he lowered his head and then swiveled my hips so that instead of his head embedding itself in my middle, the top of it was met by solid bone. That was the end of him, and St. Peter's won by about 130 points to 18, but it was still a much more even game. I think that my last months at St. Peter's were, in a childish way, the happiest time of my life. I was doing well. I was even captain of the cricket team, although I can never remember making any runs or taking many wickets. Learning was fun. I was feeling cheerful and confident. I liked everyone, and they seemed to like me, which was very important. Looking back, it seems like a golden age when all the slightly more grown-up distractions of wondering how you'll get everything done or whether you're studying hard enough to pass your exams and being disappointed that there were people who were better at you, the things you really cared about, and worrying about your skin and feeling hopelessly uncomfortable around girls were not even specks on the horizon yet. In fact, I think the only speck around was my mother. The speck? Let me explain. The salient feature of the human perceptual apparatus, the five senses, is that they are designed to detect change. A movement, a new sound, a pinprick, a different taste or smell, we immediately register it. It's a survival mechanism. If nothing's changing, we're safe. So we block out anything that isn't changing. The drilling noise that irritated us this morning doesn't impinge on us this afternoon unless we make a conscious effort to notice it. It's the same with atmospheres. You habituate to them until they feel so familiar that you cease to register them. Well, the following tale says a lot about the standard atmosphere in the Cleese household in Weston. When I was 12, we moved, again, to a second-floor flat right above St. Peter's so that my parents could watch me walk down our drive across the road, through a gate and all the way to the school's back entrance, when I would turn and wave to them. It was in this house that my dad sat me down one evening and calmly explained to me that it was likely that Mother would be moving out in a few days and going to live somewhere else, and that his sister Dorothy would move in and look after us instead. Odd to recall, this did not feel particularly dramatic or even surprising. I liked Dorothy very much, I simply thought, when Auntie comes, it'll all be calm and happy, and everyone will be nice to everyone, and everything will feel so easy. But nothing ever happened. Dad didn't mention it again. Dorothy, who'd been staying with us, went away, and I didn't see her again for a very long time. A year later, we moved to Bristol, where I was soon to start as a day boy at Clifton College. And Mother, of course, came with us. I rather liked the new home. It felt familiar because it had been Grandpa's for many years, and we used to visit him there. And when he died in 1952 at the age of 85, he left it to Dad. It was the first time we'd had a whole house. It was semi-detached, with a tiny front garden and a small back one, at the end of which was Redland Police Station, which made us feel very safe. It was my 12th home in 13 years. Partly because I have a poor visual memory and also because I never spent very long anywhere. I have only fragmentary pictures in my mind of the first 11. A bedroom where Mum pummeled Dad, the stairs up to Mrs. Phillips, the back garden where I made a century, the living room from which our budgerigar escaped in Burnham. But I can recall every room in number 2 East Shrubbery, Redland, near Clifton, Bristol, in some detail, because it was to be home for the next 5 years, practically a geological period by Cleese standards. And I spent a lot of time there, not because I was a day boy, but because even during the holidays, we very seldom ventured far. I remember it with real affection. It seemed a secure base from which to emerge into a rather more grown-up world.